Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It wasn't long after this famous challenge from President Ronald Reagan that Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev allowed Berliners to destroy the wall, and the Soviet Union collapsed soon afterward. For many, this moment 20 years ago defined the end of the Cold War. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. Later in the show, an economist who worked for Mikhail Gorbachev remembers the exciting years when his boss helped reshape the Soviet Union.
The difference between Gorbachev and other leaders of the Soviet Union was that he was really Western-style educated person. He was the right person in the right place in the right time, as American proverb says.
But first, the Cuban Missile Crisis was the closest the world ever came to all-out nuclear war. Associate producer Elliot Majerzyk has gathered some sound clips that evoke the era.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
3, 2, 1, fire.
If you receive warning of an enemy attack, get to the nearest fallout shelter promptly. But if you're caught in the open and there's a brilliant nuclear flash in the distance, take cover immediately. Even miles away, you may be exposed within seconds to a searing heat wave from the explosion. Get into the nearest building immediately, curl up in a ball, and cover your head with your arms. Stay there until heat and blast waves have passed.
Friends, this is Bob Hope. If an atom bomb were to hit your home city, would you know what to do? Remember, one explosion of an atom bomb could kill 75,000 and maim 100,000. Knowing what to do before, during, and after a disaster can improve your chances of survival.
Speaking in measured tones that are the more convincing for the contrast with his previous angry outbursts, Khrushchev threatens that if his demands are not met, the Red Bloc will bypass the United Nations.
Shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
Hello? Hello, is anybody there? Is anybody there? This is Lawrence. This is Lawrence, Kansas. Is anybody there?
Nowadays, we've become more afraid of a terrorist attack with nuclear weapons than a first strike by Russia. But that's quite a transformation, considering that for more than four decades, the entire world lived in mortal terror of the two superpowers somehow touching off nuclear annihilation. Malcolm Muir is a professor of military history at Virginia Military Institute. He says the possibility of mutual destruction during the Cold War was very real. Do you think the Cold War, we'd never had something like the Cold War before, or is that actually not true? There were pre-nuclear bomb versions of Cold Wars.
Yeah, so definitely. Rivalries between great powers that went on for centuries, France and Britain, for example. The United States was relatively new on the world stage. The U.S. had emerged as a great power during World War I. But it's in World War II that the United States clearly was the dominant Western power. Many in the United States, of course, and elsewhere, hoped that World War II would see a partnership that would be enduring between the United States and the Soviet Union. We, after all, were fighting this common enemy.
So initially, we weren't in a Cold War. We were allies with Russia. What was the moment of dawning?
As late as 1946, the year after World War II ended, many in the United States hoped that we could continue to work amicably with the Soviet Union. But Stalin, the head of the Soviet Union, was emplacing communist regimes in Western and Eastern Europe, regimes that peoples in those countries clearly did not want, but he was in control because his forces had liberated those countries from the Germans. Countries like Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, Poland, and then in 1948, Czechoslovakia. Our fear in the West here was that Stalin would not stop at Eastern Europe, that in fact he would move into Western Europe, which was in shambles as a result of World War II. I'd just like to say in regard to the origins of the Cold War that in 1948, the Soviets established a blockade of West Berlin. This is a very aggressive move on their part. They hoped to grab what Khrushchev later called the testicles of the West. not only are the communists aggressive in Eastern Europe, they establish a communist regime in the biggest, most populous country, I should say, in the world, China. Mao Tse-tung takes control in China in 1949. And from the Western standpoint, here you see one communist success after another. June of 1950, communist North Korea attacks without provocation South Korea and almost overruns it.
Had we ever seen Stalin as a tremendous ally? Was there ever a time when we thought, this is a great guy to be working with?
We saw him as an ally of convenience. We saw him as an ally who, for a time, for a long time, had borne most of the brunt of the Germans in World War II. The Soviets lost at least 28 million dead in World War II. The Soviets lost, on average, for 4 years, 19,000 people killed every single day. That is a more comprehensible figure.
So what was it that Stalin wanted, and what did he fear about the Western powers?
Certainly wanted security for the Soviet Union, for his regime, for himself personally. Stalin was a paranoid, and Stalin's rule was dictatorial. The way Stalin treated his own people was, to any perceptive Westerner, an index of how Stalin would act in control of other countries. In his own country, Stalin purged the military. Stalin purged civilian society. Stalin put people in jail by the millions. Murdered them. 3 out of 5 field marshals before World War II were murdered. 14 out of 16 army commanders. 60 out of 67 corps commanders. Stalin's purges went all the way through Soviet society.
When did the Soviet Union begin to acquire weapons of mass destruction? What was the genesis of that?
The Soviets had agents in the Manhattan Project. We explode our first nuclear device in 1945, they in 1949. The United States saw the atomic bomb as the great equalizer. The Soviets had such a large army after World War II. They had 175 divisions in 1947. The United States had reduced its army to 10. So the atomic bomb was the equalizer. That would give the Americans, in the view of the Truman administration, the advantage in World War III, were it to come to that. The Truman administration was terrified of a return of the Great Depression and was demobilizing American armed forces very quickly. But the atomic bomb was the safety valve. The Soviets didn't have it until 1949.
Why were they afraid of a return of the Great Depression? And how, if the war was what people popularly now believe got us out of the Depression, why were they demobilizing?
Why were they demobilizing? Because the American people insisted on it. Is the United States going to support 15 million Americans in uniform? The American people are simply not going to support an armed force that big without a mortal peril. And so the Truman administration was demobilizing, some said too hastily.
So in addition to using nuclear weapons as the great equalizers, what was the U.S. plan for dealing with the threat that we saw in Stalin first and later in other Soviet leaders?
The U.S. plan was to attack the Soviets the way we had attacked Japan, hit at the Soviet centers of power, principally Moscow. The relatively feeble American nuclear arsenal in the late 1940s is best illustrated by the remark to Congress in closed session by a major general in the United States Air Force, Earl Partridge, who said, "We should plan to do the job with a B-29 on a one-way basis. It will be the cheapest thing we ever did. Expend the bomb, expend the airplane, expend the crew all at once. Kiss them goodbye and let them go. This is a pretty cold-blooded point of view, but I believe that it is economically best for the country."
When was that statement uncovered and popularly known?
This after the Cold War. Needless to say, the B-29 airmen were not enthusiastic about this approach. What we needed was a plane with a bigger range and a plane that would be survivable in an attack on the Soviet Union. Hence, there is this great impetus to develop advanced weapons.
What was our strategy for neutralizing the threat that we perceived during the Cold War?
American strategy was enunciated by the diplomat George Kennan in July of 1947, and that was contain the Soviet Union, not attempt to roll back the Soviet gains in Eastern Europe. That would precipitate World War III. But contain them. Don't allow them to expand into Central Europe. Kennan predicted that the Soviet system was so awkward, so tyrannical, and inefficient that if you contained it, it would collapse inward of its own weight. He was asked, how long would this take? He predicted 50 years. That's not too bad, because 1947, the Soviet system collapsed Christmas Day 1991. That's pretty close to 50 years.
How early in the Cold War were we sure we didn't want a war with Russia? Was there ever a point where we thought, let's just bring it on?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is that there's one person that people can point to as the fellow who really wanted war with the Soviet Union, and that was the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, Curtis LeMay, who in 1957 told a closed session of Congress, the Finletter Commission, that would, if he saw the Soviets as preparing to attack the United States, he would strike the Soviet Union with SAC, the Strategic Air Command, with the B-52s. Informed by a congressman that a first strike against the Soviet Union was not an American policy, his reply was, it's my policy. I'm going to do it.
What was the reaction to that?
Amazingly, he kept his uniform. Can you imagine? But that's an anomaly. What I'm saying is he never did it, right? Containment was, at its bottom, was we're going to avoid war with the Soviet Union by making sure that they cannot reasonably survive a surprise attack on the United States. And ultimately, most Russians in power realized this. And this is where I point to the end of the Cold War. Gorbachev acts on that realization. In 1986, one of his key advisors, Anatoly Chernyev, wrote in his diary, Gorbachev has really decided to end the arms race no matter what. He is taking this, quote, risk, unquote, because, as he understands, it is no risk at all, because nobody will attack us if we disarm completely, unquote.
So in addition to learning what we have now learned about Gorbachev's statement in 1986, what has the opening of documents about this period in Soviet history taught historians about what the Soviets were thinking along these times?
Let me give a personal aside. I attended a conference in Poland recently on the Cold War, and we looked at Warsaw Pact, that is Soviet plans, for fighting a war in Europe. And what the Soviet plans call for, these are mid-1960 plans, was a first strike by the Soviet forces against NATO defenses. The Soviet plans call for the use of over 10,000 tactical nuclear weapons, each more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. And it gets quite frightening to look at these Soviet plans for nuclear war in Europe that would have absolutely devastated Europe.
Tell me a little about who the Soviet leaders were during this period. Stalin died when?
Stalin died in March of 1953. And Stalin's death precipitated a power struggle in the Soviet Union. Out of that emerged Nikita Khrushchev. By 1956, Khrushchev was taking a markedly different course, in some ways, from Stalin. Khrushchev was announcing peaceful coexistence with the West as a policy for the Soviet Union, although, in fact, he increases military spending on new weapons, particularly long-range rockets, so that the Soviet Union could strike the United States from missiles launched in Soviet territory, strike the United States itself.
What was Khrushchev's role in the great Cuban Missile Crisis that we all remember?
The Cuban Missile Crisis, the closest the world ever came to nuclear war, the most dangerous moment in the history of mankind, in fact. Recent evidence shows that the Soviets had over 300 nuclear warheads in Cuba by early October of 1962, that the Soviet commanders there, this is more frightening, had release authority for those weapons. That is, they could have ordered them fired. And Khrushchev had more weapons on the way to Cuba when, in the words of Dean Rusk, we were eyeball to eyeball and they blinked. Khrushchev backs down. Now, it's not just Khrushchev backing down, although that's the way the American public commonly perceived it, but there was a trade. The Soviets would withdraw their missiles from Cuba. We would withdraw our intermediate-range ballistic missiles from Turkey.
What threat had we made that made Khrushchev blink?
It was a clever use of the language. Kennedy instituted what he called a quarantine against Soviet ships carrying additional missiles toward Cuba. Kennedy didn't use the word blockade because in international law, the use of that word is equivalent to a declaration of war. Castro was egging Khrushchev on to take a stronger stand. In other words, Castro's ready for World War III. And by the 1960s, we had not hundreds of nuclear weapons, we had thousands of them deployed. And these weapons, if they were launched from intercontinental ballistic missiles, would travel from the United States to the Soviet Union, or vice versa, in 30 minutes, which meant that you had 15 minutes to respond.
What lessons do you think we should take from the Cold War of the 20th century?
The amount of money spent was just ghastly. Yet, at the same time, if we avoided World War III, it was money well spent.
So after Gorbachev announced that he does not think if the Soviet Union disarms, the U.S. will attack it, how then did the conclusion of the Cold War proceed?
Gorbachev begins cutting to the bone spending on the Soviet military and laying up many of these very expensive ships and disestablishing divisions to the disquiet, of course, of many of the people in the top ranks of the Soviet command. But Gorbachev begins unilaterally cutting back on the Soviet spending. How big was Soviet spending on its military establishment? Maybe 50% of the gross national product? And then, of course, concomitant with this is the increasing independence by the Eastern European satellites, who are now flying out of their orbit. Countries like Hungary, East Germany, Poland are taking independent steps. In 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down. I never in my life thought I'd see people standing on top of the Berlin Wall with picks, hacking away at it. It was just wonderful. But 2 years later, within 2 years, the Soviet Union itself is gone. On Christmas Day, 1991, Gorbachev signs an order. It's his last order as head of the Soviet Union, dissolving that entity. I never in my life thought I would see that.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate.
Malcolm Muir is a professor of military history at Virginia Military Institute and director of the John A. Adams Center for Military History and Strategic Analysis.